Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Fringe Show. Today, I am joined by Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are things going? What's up? What's down?
It's all up and upside down.
Yes. And also, we have Mr. Marius Ruiz. Marius, how's it cracking?
Lacking you guys.
Yeah, it's all right. I saw yesterday someone was criticizing us for being an old boys club of people who constantly slap each other's backs, to which I will say, Morris and Gabriel, you're both looking very wise and magnificent today.
How well put, Nicholas. How very well put.
Nick, Nick, I have to say your beard trim makes you look exceedingly brilliant today.
Thank you. I just want to say, because some of our live stream listeners, they ask about what time we start. We usually create the broadcast around 1:30. In a perfect world, that's perhaps when we would start. But we then have a pre-show discussion just to finalize exactly what we're going to talk about. And that usually takes about 15 minutes. So we normally start about 1:45. Obviously, to those watching this later and those listening to the audio, this isn't really a consideration. But anyway, let us get stuck into the first story of today, and that is a survey by Afrobarometer. So they've been asking South Africans questions about how they feel about various institutions in the country, and they have found that about 64% of those surveyed say that corruption has increased in the past year, and 49% of those surveyed said that it hadn't just increased, but it had increased a lot, is the exact phrasing. This was from a survey done in May and June of this year, where they interviewed 1,600 adult South Africans. The Afrobarometer says it's about a margin of error of 2.5 percentage points. And basically, it seems like almost every institution in the country has very bad favorability ratings in terms of how corrupt people think it is, how functional people think it is. Low scorers being things, to no surprise, like the police, which are not particularly trusted by anyone. So, Gabriel, let me start with you. The way this was headlined in the media was corruption worsening during Ramaphosa's 10-year survey. That seems to be pretty much the case. Is the shine going off Ramaphosa a bit?
I think that it's harder to find someone who still believes in the new dawn than vice versa amongst even a certain level of like journalists. So I will grant you that when I go to the plush parts of Johannesburg suburbs, I've just had a cocktail party weekend of seeing old aristocrats. A lot of faith still in Ramaphosa, but these are people who live behind very high walls, who have no interaction with government because they've got private healthcare, private schooling for their kids if they have kids. They sort of holiday overseas, and they don't work anymore. They sort of have assets that are offshored and that accrue them incomes. So I think amongst that
must be nice.
Amongst that segment of society, there's still a lot of faith in the new dawn. But I think for people that have been confronted with reality, very little. So Marius Ruiz draw our attention to another piece by Peter Bruce being very critical of Ramaphosa. And I wanted to say, I told you so. When Peter Bruce was championing the new dawn, my analysis was that he knew he was talking nonsense, but that he was saying this because it was the fashionable thing to say at the time. I think one of the interesting things about the and part of the reason I said that is because the same thing happened under Zuma. When Zuma first came to power, a lot of people were like, oh, he's great. And then suddenly they were like, no, he's not great. Right. Why did you change your mind?
He's a man of the people who's going to bring the presidency down to earth again.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas I actually did change my mind because I really did think he was great. But then I changed my mind quite quickly when he was punting ideas like expropriation without compensation that clearly would harm most people. So that's just an aside. What's interesting about the presidency is that just over 50% of people think that there's corruption within the president's office. But Afrobarometer has previously found a kind of 60% favorability rating for Ramaphosa himself. So the idea is that the perception of corruption is encroaching so far that it's now everywhere excepting inside of Ramaphosa himself. That's an interesting finding. The most interesting finding to me is the perception of what happens to people who report on corruption. What happens to not just whistleblowers, but people who try and do something about it. And they've got 3/4 of respondents saying, if you try and hold the corrupt to account, you're likely to suffer punishment. And that's up almost 20% on what their results were in 2018. So there is a moment, or there's a unit within our body politic where perception really is what matters. If you perceive it to be the case that holding the corrupt to account is going to get you punished, that perception is what's going to stop you from acting, from seeing something and then saying something, as the slogan is in the New York City subway. I think that we are still in the strange universe of two South Africas, where people perceive correctly what the problem is. They perceive that corruption within government is a nightmare issue. They perceive on our polling that governments use all kinds of race-based excuses to deflect from that. They perceive that things are getting worse despite all the promises that they've been getting better. And yet the question is, do you go out and make the change? And part of that's about voting. Part of that is about not saying it privately, anonymously to a pollster, but saying it out loud. And the two South Africans, the South Africa that's noisy and loud, and that's in love with the status quo, really, at least in far, as far as ideas go, doesn't like inequality, doesn't like the legacy of apartheid, but does definitely like the set of policies that we've had for the last 10 years that have been driving in this direction. That's noisy South Africa. That's a South Africa that'll burn things in the rural heartlands and that'll go on TV and radio in the urban centers and speak its voice. There's this other South Africa that's unfortunately very quiet, but I think it is very reasonable. It is very commonsensical. And this is what our polling shows. And it's what Afrobarometer's polling is showing here. And I think that those in power, will have their teeth set on edge by these results. They have put so much effort into the New Dawn narrative to see it so decisively once again debunked. Must be making them feel very insecure on top of all of the other problems in the ruling alliance right now, including basic bankruptcy.
So, Marius, firstly, what do you make of this topic in general? But also specifically, why do you think that Ramaphosa has been able to so consistently sort of float above the mess of his own government? I'm not quite sure how he's done it, but it has been done for people to separate in their mind the idea of Ramaphosa from the government, which he is the leader of, and in many ways an almost unchallenged leader inside the ANC these days, as the RET faction seems to be losing power.
He's kind of a Teflon man. Nothing seems to stick to the guy. And I don't know if it's just because after Jacob Zuma, people were happy to have somebody who could, you know, who seemed to have a bit of gravitas and could actually read out 6 numbers in front of him fairly easily. And but there's definitely something about him. But maybe it's also he's still got this maybe aura around him from being one of the, you know, inverted commas, founders of the Constitution of the New South Africa with Rolf Meyer and what have you. And also he's never been personally implicated in corruption. There have been things around him, the Basasa issues and all that kind of stuff, but it always seems to have bounced off him, and he, as I say, he himself has never really been implicated in this stuff. But I do think it's very interesting how we're seeing scales are falling off people's eyes at a rate of knots at the moment. We just saw Peter Bruce with quite a hard-hitting column today. We've seen Ferial Haffagy, who's always been a big ANC fan, complaining about the ANC. And I just saw that today there's a tweet by Magda Virchiska, former head of Signia, who the Institute of Race Relations has had a couple of tangles with. And she was also a big supporter of Cyril Ramaphosa. She gave his campaign to become the ANC president a couple of million. And she shared Peter Bruce's article on Twitter with the caption saying, "Beyond depressing, there's not one policy on the table to help deal with unemployment, poor education, infrastructure collapse, etc. Not one. There's zero attempt at even recognizing the problem." And I kind of want to ask people who are disappointed with Cyril Ramaphosa now, what did you expect? When he became president, what was different from what was coming before? We know he never came and said, "Look, we're going to free the private sector. We're going to get rid of BE." You know, he never came and said, "Property rights are very important." He's a he's a product of the ANC, and he'll do what the ANC wants to do. And we've actually seen, since he became president, there's been a ramping up of these, you know, very status policies. We see now the new Employment Act bill is probably going to go through soon, where there might be basically racial quotas for different sectors. EWC has been ramped up under him. Things like NHR are still around. So, I mean, nobody should be surprised that this is happening. Cyril Ramaphosa has actually never pretended to be anything but what he's showing us to be.
But can I jump in there to say he is rich? And South Africa is a fresh democracy. And even in old democracies, people confuse wealth with respect for free markets. So I remember the polling in 2017 showing that 80% of ANC supporters preferred Ramaphosa to Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma to take over, and that 85% preferred more business-friendly policies to radical economic transformation. People did not want radical economic transformation, i.e. expropriation without compensation, NHI, hiked minimum wages, all this kind of stuff that drives up unemployment and that makes life only nicer for a kind of upper crust aristocrat. People didn't want that. They wanted common sense jobs growth policies. And they assumed that the rich guy would want that too. That's not how it works.
It's a perception I've heard so many times of people saying, no, Cyril understands the economy because he's a businessman.
But there's a difference between being pro-free markets and being a crony capitalist. And actually, even Gabriel makes a good point. Just because you actually understand the free market doesn't mean you're going to be pro the free markets. You know, lots of people who've made their money working hard, built big businesses, are also pro, policies that lock up smaller competitors and so on. Yeah, so just because you have money doesn't mean you're going to be pro the free market.
Right, the pull up the ladder approach, which is I've climbed the tower now.
Exactly. No one else can. Sorry for you.
All right, so let's move on. I see there's something we didn't plan to cover today, but I think we should probably just say something about it. Someone asked in the comments, you know, what's going on with the constitutional amendment on expropriation without compensation? I don't want to spend too much time on this because we didn't prepare for it today, but my understanding, and Gabriel and Marius can correct me if I'm wrong, but is that we really don't know precisely what the EFF is going to do at the last minute, whether they are going to support the EWC provision. They seem like they're not going to, but I don't know. Gabriel, your thoughts very briefly.
So my understanding is that the wording has been adopted. Okay, so this is what's happened. There is a version of the expropriation without compensation bill that Parliament can vote on. The date for that hasn't been set, but when that happens, it could happen. Parliament's obviously closed for business now, and will only reopen after the national municipal election. So probably it'll only really open up next year. Kind of got the rest of the year. We'll see. Maybe there'll be some business in November. When that happens, the big question is, do they have the two-thirds majority they need to amend the Constitution? Now, they might not have the two-thirds majority because the EFF seems to be unsatisfied with the status of the bill as it is. Because right now it says communism in certain places, but the EFF wants to say communism everywhere. And certain could mean everywhere. Maybe it doesn't mean everywhere. So the EFF might say this is not radical enough, so we don't want to vote on it. And then we'll blame the ANC and say that they've been captured by white monopoly capital. Look, they went for only half expropriation without compensation, or they went for expropriation without compensation without total custodianship to go along with it, which is the technical term for turning land and the assets thereupon into government resources. That's the big mystery. What's the EFF going to do? Another big mystery that I don't want to get lost is that two-thirds might not be enough. There is an argument. Yes. I believe this argument is correct, that two-thirds is not enough in any event, that this is a rule of law issue, that this would take a three-quarters majority. This would take as much of a majority as it would to say that we're giving the Northwest to Namibia or whoever you want to give it away. You know, this is a major structural issue. You can't change this without changing the structure of our country. And so you need a three quarters majority. So in that event, doesn't matter if the EFF and ANC vote together, they still won't have the ability to pass it.
Right. Maurice, any thoughts on that very briefly before we move on?
I just think that a three quarters majority probably wouldn't even be that impossible. The only party that would definitely vote against this, I think, are the DA, ACDP, Freedom Front Plus, and COPE. And together, just having a look quickly, they get to 23.5, 24.5 plus Cope's 0.5% of parliamentary seats gives you 25% on the nose. So
I'm so glad I voted for Cope. They will definitely vote.
Look, I might be wrong, and this is quickly looking now. I'm just doing some calculations in my head. But I mean, obviously, if the EFF decides to step away, then this thing will be dead in the water. So let's hope
no,
so.
It's tight. And if they get 2/3 of majority, then you have to fight in court about whether it really should have been 3/4. In the meanwhile, it's being implemented. In the meanwhile, money leaves. In the meanwhile, jobs go down, crimes goes up, rebellion, insurrection, all of the nightmares continue, and you're putting more pressure on the court. So it'd definitely be better if there's not even a 2/3 majority. But even if there isn't, the expropriation bill, which is a separate issue, can still go through. And under the interpretation that's being pushed by the ANC, that would not require a constitutional amendment. It would allow expropriation without compensation. That's why we've been fighting that as well. You've got to fight everywhere. This is whack-a-mole. The bad ideas pop up left, right, and you've got to smack them down wherever you can.
No, exactly. All right. Thank you, gentlemen, for tackling that topic without preparing. And let us move overseas now to the great geopolitical shifts that are going on around us. Of course, we've talked, many people have been talking, and including us on the show, about the sort of Cold War 2.0, electric boogaloo. And it looks like a new development has happened in the race to build an alliance against China's growing power. The United States, the leaders of the United States, Great Britain, and Australia yesterday announced that for the first time since 1958, they would be sharing the technology required to manufacture nuclear-propelled submarines to the Australians so that they can prepare their navy to be well stronger. So what they didn't say was that this is to counter the growing strength of the Chinese navy. In fact, they specifically denied that. But it did, of course, get a stern rebuke from Beijing, with the Chinese saying no one should be making bilateral agreements that come at the expense of a third party, which is very sort of wishy-washy diplomatic speak for, hey, you can't be making alliances without us. So I don't know who wants to take this first. I guess I'll start with Gabriel. Why are nuclear propelled submarines so important? This isn't submarines that use nuclear weapons. It's just submarines powered by nuclear weapons. Why is this such an important thing in geopolitics and world?
Yeah. So part of the reason that it's a big deal is just very practical. The ocean is the last place you can hide from satellites. Now, The Economist has supposed has noticed a couple of years ago that there are satellite technological developments that might allow radio waves to penetrate the ocean so that you can basically X-ray the oceans from space, and then we'll be in a whole different world. But right now, if you want to hide and move, the only place you can hide and move is underwater. That makes submarines extremely important assets that are limited by the fact that they have to return to refuel. And when they're coming into harbor and they're refueling, that's when you can track it. And then you can try and follow it around. And so the more often it has to come back, the less time it can spend being undetected, undetectable, and surprising. Surprise being a key concept in any military strategy. So the nuclear submarine just offers much more. We were having a discussion about how much more time it offers out under the waves, undetectably. Let's say half a year if you're pushing it.
Right. Although basically
regular schedules will bring you.
Right. You need to refuel the thing, I think, once every couple of years, or even longer. But the main problem is that you just run out of food and water in the end because
Yeah. Exactly. So, and then what you put on your submarine, you can put nukes on your submarine, and then you can launch them from anywhere. Trident, sort of the UK's program has been based on that for a very long time, but also conventional weapons. Submarines are devastating; can be devastating. Modern submarines to aircraft carriers. Aircraft carriers have traditionally been the major expression of power in the Pacific. China's acquisition of an aircraft carrier, remodeling and refitting and adding a second one to their fleet, has been one of the major shifts in realpolitik balance of forces in the Pacific theater in the last decade. So this is just another move to kind of countervail that countervailing force in some sense. If Australia has got nuclear subs that are swimming around and hard to track and hard to trace. So I think that's part of why it matters. Another part of the second major reason it matters practically is that the kind of fuel that nuclear submarines are running on, very highly refined uranium, might easily sort of cover for weapons grade uranium. So the more you expand the universe of countries, the number of countries that can operate nuclear submarines, the higher the chances that some kind of weapons grade nukes are being smuggled around. And that's part of the reason New Zealand doesn't allow any kind of nuclear stuff around it at all, because it's like, okay, we're fine with nuclear power generation, but we're afraid of the risks, both politically and in terms of sort of just degradation fallout. So we don't want anything like that around. So it's kind of awkward for Australia to have these submarines and it can't go near New Zealand. Of course, it's not clear that New Zealand could stop it, submarines, especially nuclear submarines, being hard to find and some of the ocean beds being quite deep there. But those are the two main things, is that's a bit of a risk giving new tech to Australia and you worry about them smuggling new nukes, but excepting you think that's not really likely to happen, I don't anyway. So then the main thing is this is a countervailing force in the Pacific theater against China. And what does China do next? I don't know. They seem to be moving forward pretty steamily in any event.
So one of the other countries in the world that does actually have access to nuclear subs currently, I think we were trying to list them before the show: Russia, the United States, Great Britain, France, India, China, and now Australia will be joining that club. And it does look like the US is really trying to build an alliance of countries in the region. As someone in the comments mentioned, Japan is also militarizing in response to China's growing naval strength. And so, yeah, it really does look like we're set off for a much tenser Asia, particularly in the South China Sea, which is very heavily contested between China and all the countries in that region. Maurice, your thoughts on this topic? I see someone in the comments is talking about how Australia was hurt by Chinese economic war with China because the Chinese refused to buy Australian goods. And it looks like Australia's decided to respond aggressively to hemp's.
They've been building up their military for some time now, and they're going to be spending a lot more of their military in the next couple of years. I just want to point one thing that Gabriel said. I don't think the Americans are too worried about giving refined nuclear stuff to Australia. I don't see a bogan government taking over in Canberra and deciding to nuke, I don't know, whatever.
Nuke the All Blacks if they choose it. Yeah. Exactly. Nuke us if
we win the rugby, yeah.
I think the Australians are probably fairly trustworthy, but who knows, things can change quite quickly. So, but also somebody made a point in the comments that nuclear submarines are also a lot quieter. They're much harder to detect, just from the sound of it compared to diesel and electric and so on. But this is also this is just part of, as you say, it's part of a growing tensions in the South Pacific and Indian Ocean also. And there's as when I was reading about this before the show too, there's something called the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, and that's between Australia, India, the US, and Japan. And that's also these four countries cooperate on certain issues, share intelligence, military hardware and whatever. So there definitely does seem to be there's a growing kind of call it the new allies or whatever in the South Pacific or in the Pacific or the Indo-Pacific, let's call it that broadly, to fight against the Chinese. And I think, I mean, that is definitely going to be the biggest geopolitical issue in the first half of the 21st century. And let's hope it doesn't get to war. But at the moment, it might be one of those things that historians in 2050 might look back and say, like, look, it was inevitable. Look what was happening. So let's hope it doesn't happen.
Nicholas is muted.
Yeah, you're muted, Nick.
Wisdom.
Anyway, sorry. One more thing I wanted to say before we move on is just that another reason that this might change the geostrategic balance is, of course, we all know that China is very interested in taking control of Taiwan, which it claims as part of its territory. And if there was a potential Chinese invasion, it would, of course, need to be conducted navally across the straits there. And with the U.S. Navy being kind of stretched thin and far away, The Australian Navy, having some very, very advanced, powerful submarines able to intercept such an invasion force, would possibly change the balance of power in the region in that very specific way. So that's another way that this sort of factors into that. Anyway, let us move on to our last two topics today, which is sort of a bit of a bundle, and that is the series of major elections coming up in the world. So we have an election in Germany on the, I think it's the 26th of September, and we have an election on the 20th of September in Canada, where Justin Trudeau is facing off against a powerful conservative challenge from Aaron O'Toole, is his name, which is an unfortunate name for a politician. But Maurice, very briefly, do you think that Trudeau is going to be able to hang on again? He only hung on very slightly last time. Do you think he might be toast?
Seems the polling is very close. The latest polling has Trudeau's party, the Liberals, just ahead of the Conservatives, O'Toole's party. And from what it looks like, Trudeau's probably going to get the most seats in Parliament again, but he's probably going to miss out on a majority. So that's probably, it's going to be a hung Parliament again. And it probably depends by how much Trudeau misses out, whether there could be some kind of coalition that forces him out. And that doesn't look too likely, though, because the third biggest party, I think it's called the New Democratic Party in Canada, is also kind of on the left. They're a bit more left-wing than the Liberals in Canada. So if there was, I would imagine that there'd be more likely to be a coalition between the Liberals and the NDP, as they're called, rather than the Conservatives and anybody else. But it remains to be seen, and shows that Trudeau's been pretty much on the back foot over the last couple of years, and he's probably not going to be Prime Minister of Canada for, you know, too much longer, but who knows.
Gabriel, your thoughts quickly on Canadian election?
Yeah, I think that it's an interesting case where Trudeau kind of forced the issue, assuming that if he could get this snap election...
Right, he thought it would be a slam dunk for him.
He thought it'd be amazing. Everyone loves me. I'm dealing with COVID so well. I told Donald Trump that he's an orange orangutan, so I'm the best. Didn't work. And I just to draw the parallel, likewise in California, those people who called the recall election against Gavin Newsom, it looks like it's going to work, but it didn't work out for them. Much like with Brexit, the people who called the Brexit referendum were Remainers. So it seems somehow he who calls the election loses the election, if not outright, at least compared to where we thought we were. Theresa May had the same problem herself. So I think Trudeau is just relearning a lesson that one thought might already have sunk in. In terms of Germany, my fiance is a German citizen and refuses to talk about the war or anything to do with even whether she's going to vote. There does look like Merkel.
Well, she's also Russian, so the war is a bit complicated for her.
Very complicated. I think Angela, Stephen Covey, I think Seven Habits of Highly Successful People. I think it's him who said a great test of the ultimate test of leadership is when you leave, does the bus keep going or does it kind of fall apart in your wake? Did you make yourself indispensable? Indispensability is actually not a great sign of leadership. It's sort of narcissistic, paranoid, like you couldn't delegate, you couldn't really inspire others to do their job. And Merkel does seem to fail this test. We will get confirmation, but it does seem that her departure also means the departure of the CDU and the introduction of the SDP, the sort of more lefty, I think the Social Democratic Party they're called, coming into power. That's what the poll snapshots are looking at like right now. Although I'm advised by Germans that a last minute lurch back to the center is not unprecedented. It's the kind of things that Germans suddenly get very practical. It's the last minute and they say, okay, we're going to just do the tried and tested thing. You do it like this and you do it.
To be fair, the SDP is pretty in the center pretty much. They're not, you know, they're not crazy lefties, but that's also one of the issues. The CDU's been warning if the SDP does emerge as the biggest party, they might go into coalition with the Linke, which are basically the old East German communists. But I think it's inevitable.
They're called the left.
Exactly. But it's inevitable. There is going to be a coalition in Germany. Who knows what it's going to look like. But I think the CDU also missed the trick by their Chancellor candidate is also very uninspiring. And a lot of people say they should have actually made the guy who's the basically the Premier of Bavaria and the leader of the sister party, the CSU, the candidate for Chancellor. But yeah, but we'll see what happens in a couple of days.
Yeah, no, I'm just looking at the opinion polling now, and it's very interesting. You can find this graph on Wikipedia on the page about the German elections this year. But the CDU was doing pretty well, pretty far ahead in the polls until about the beginning of this year when the Greens overtake it for a bit. And then the Greens fall over to be replaced by a sudden huge surge from the SPD, the Social Democrats. So we'll have to see. I mean, you know, maybe there'll be a bit of wonkiness in the final results. I don't trust very sudden surges like this in polling. But you never know. Maybe something will happen and the CDU will finally fall out of power after many, many years at the helm in Germany.
16 years, I think.
Yeah. Anyway,
might that's be good.
Have for today.
Rejuvenation. Yeah, well,
that's good.
I'm not sure if I think it's great that the SPD is getting in power, but it's always good to change your government every now and again. And yeah, we'll have to see what happens. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for watching. Please support the dailyfriend.co.za. You can go to it, check out all of our news and opinion articles, and see what you think. It's good stuff there. And yeah, we will see you next week. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone. And yeah, have a wonderful rest of the day.